This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
The world is fast running out of fresh water, according to experts, and the results could be very grim. More wildfires, droughts, rationing, less food, more hunger. The causes are linked to overconsumption and a growing human population. Can we reverse the trend? Our next guest says we can, and he has quantified how much each of us contribute to either the continuing water crisis or averting it. Tom Costigan is the best-selling author of several books, including The Green Book, The Everyday Guide to Saving the Planet One Simple Step at a Time, You Are Here, The Surprising Link Between What We Do and What That Does to the Planet, and his latest, The Green Blue Book, The Simple Water Savings Guide to Everything in Your Life. He joined us now in studio. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for getting the subtitles correct.
So, okay, let's start with the problem. You have said in your book that since dinosaur times that we really have had the same amount of water. It sounds like you're saying that's all changing now.
Well, it is because of a couple different things that you mentioned in the introduction. One is population growth, of course. So there's more of us. And then, of course, technology and the things that we use, our stuff. You know, the average home has 10,000 items in it in the United States. That's an awful lot of stuff. And things go into making that stuff. One of those things is water. So we're taking more out of the system just to create things for our own use as well as the things that we use. And then the other missing link of all this is our pollution of that water. So there's less fresh water or usable water, and we're seeing more and more of that. You know, Ban Ki-moon said that more people are dying from unsafe water than all the violence and all the wars in the world.
That's pretty profound.
Very.
You have mentioned that there is this global water cycle that occurs. Mm-hmm. So if we were just going to put this in simple terms for people, how this actually works and how it relates to how much fresh water we have.
Sure. Now you're going to make me get into the science.
No, you have to.
But I'm glad.
Our audience is like that.
Yes. The water that falls onto the planet, just to put it into perspective from the water cycle, is about 3 feet that would cover the entire planet. In fresh water. So you start to take that away and chip away at it. And then all of a sudden you start to say, well, okay, water is molecules, H2O, two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen. We know that from school. These molecules bounce around in different ways. So the rain here in California may have been at one point water in the Great Lakes or snow in the Sierras or someplace in the Himalayas. So when you start to conceptualize it that way and see that we all share in this massive pot of water, we in the United States take twice as much as everybody else in the world on average. So the average person in the U.S. needs about 13 gallons of water on a daily basis. That's to drink, to bathe, to wash. We use close to 150 gallons each. In a third world country, they use 5 gallons. We use that in one flush of the toilet. So that is really the disconnect that we have to start to chip away at so that we can all make smarter decisions. And one of those ways that I get to in the book is through virtual water. And virtual water is the embedded water in everything. How much is in your blue jeans? How much is in your...
How did you calculate this? I was looking at all these numbers and I thought to myself, how the heck did he do this?
Yeah. Well, in the back of the book, as you saw, there's a massive reference section. So we use base ingredients. And once you start to get down to the base ingredients, how much does it take for a pound of oats, for example? 123 gallons. Okay, who eats oats? Cattle. How much water do they need? How much water is in the processing? So you start to see how we put the pieces together. How much water for cotton? Then we can start to say, oh, that's how we get 3,000 gallons
for
blue jeans.
You did this for furniture. You did this for, you did it for everything.
Yes. I'm partially crazy because of it. A lot of calculations going on in my head, and really it just takes everything down to its base. And once you start to realize, we make up a lot of stuff, but there are base ingredients for everything. How much, the cotton, and then you get into rayon, then you get into aluminum, then you get into certain food products, and you can really start to chip away at it again, to use that word, and break it down to its very basics, which I think is a great thing for everyone to do. Figure out what we're buying, figuring out what's in the stuff that we're buying, and whether that's on our back or whether we're ingesting it, it's a very healthy proposition for people.
Yeah, in fact, you broke it down in terms of, first of all, in terms of industry. So farming, I think you said, was the largest consumer of water, which makes sense.
Yeah, 70% of all fresh water goes to agriculture.
And then industry.
Mm-hmm. Second biggest, 20%.
And then the rest of it is personal consumption.
That's us, 10%.
So if we were going to look at an average American's lifestyle, and you were going to say, these are the 10 areas that people should address first, what would you say those top 10 are?
First one, energy. May be surprising to a lot of people. 50% of the water in the United States goes to create electricity. For every time you turn on the tap for just a few minutes, that's equivalent to a 60-watt bulb being burned for 14 hours. I mean, there's all these kind of calculations you can get into. There is a nexus between what we do and what that does. So energy is a big one. Turn off the lights when you leave the room. You save energy, you save water, you save money. Buy local. Forget about transportation costs. Also, how much water does it take to grow things in arid nations? A lot of people have Egyptian cotton shirts or sheets. Egypt, last time I checked, is a desert country. It's 100% irrigation. We forget about these things, so try and buy something a little local. Cotton in the United States is likely only 50% irrigated. So we can make smarter decisions by buying local, you know, thinking about what we're doing in terms of our energy use, and then seeing what are the biggest consumers in terms of the ingredients. So taking a look at our food choices and seeing, should we be buying, you know, peaches in January? Probably not, because they've been stored. There's a lot of water in these things. Can we recycle? Because when you start to look at the enormous amount of water it takes to create virgin ore for aluminum, it's massive. You can chop that down by an exponent by recycling. Then look at your other products. There's 3 liters of water to make a 1 liter plastic water bottle. That's without the water inside it. So you start to make these choices throughout all the shifts in your life and thinking about not throwing things away. You know, it gets back to the 3 R's. Reduce, reuse, recycle. That little cup at the bottom of the coffee pot that you toss out without thinking about it adds up to an enormous, enormous number, and it's in the book. And
yeah, you actually did quantify some of these. Let me see if I wrote any of them down. You used the coffee example. You said if one person keeps one cup of water from being sent down the drain, that we have enough to provide 2 million gallons to the 1.1 billion people who have no access to fresh water.
Well, that's everyone who drinks coffee, but yeah.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. Just if you're drinking coffee and you're tossing that away, think about that. That one cup represents 590 cups of water, 37 gallons to look at it another way. So starting to think about, you know, things like coffee. Coffee's the second most traded commodity in the world besides oil. I mean, we have to start to think about what we're using, where it's coming from, and then being conscious and maybe a little bit more conservative about our use.
I thought the food choice section was quite interesting, too. And some of it, you know, I think our listeners probably know to some degree, at least they know that vegetables take far less water than does eating meat. Mm-hmm. But it's a huge difference. I don't know if I wrote down the numbers. Do you have them memorized?
Sure. I mean, if you look at swapping out, say, a veggie burger for a hamburger, you save 600 gallons. A salad
in one meal.
One meal.
Right one there. Meal, 600 yeah. gallons of water.
Yeah, yeah. It's about between 1,300 and 1,500, depends on the cut, of meat, of gallons of water for meat.
Now, for listeners don't understand why that is, the whole chain of the water, you started to say some of that in the beginning. Mm-hmm. I sort of cut you off. So why don't you explain that again?
Sure. Beef and any type of meat, of course, the higher you go up the food chain, the more water it takes. So beef, cattle in the United States eat a lot of oats. Oats take about 123 gallons themselves of water to be grown. So you have that step in the cycle. You have to grow the oats, 123 gallons there per pound. Then once the cattle themselves have to be fed, you're into another equation of water. Then that meat has to be processed and packaged and then transported. So all of a sudden, it goes way up the chain as opposed to, say, you know, potatoes or corn or other types of vegetables that are just very low on the food chain. So, you know, the lesson there is to eat dirty and, you know, eat things that are less sweet. Sugar takes a lot of water.
Okay. And so then the other big issue, especially in the U.S., you talked about is the garden.
Yeah. We use about 70% of our residential water for our lawns. Big problem with that. You know, we can cut back here in Los Angeles. As we know, we get to water twice a week. In my neighborhood, at least, a lot of people don't pay attention to that. And I, you know, try and make that known.
Come on, in LA, they're supposed to be rationing.
They should be. That's right. But a lot of people aren't aware of it. And I think that's a great thing. As you probably know, we've shored up about 25% of our water supplies just from rationing. 23%, something like that. So, you know, once we start to think about what are we using it for, do we really need imported turf? Can we start to do things like Xeriscape? Can we then cut back on just, you know, the profligate use for our outdoor water plants? Just for plants alone, most outdoor plants, according to gardeners, are overwatered by 50%. Indoor plants by 90%. We don't think about it. We just think they should be wet all the time, but we don't realize how much water that really encompasses. And a little shifts in habit like that add up to a huge, huge, huge number.
The other one that was really remarkable was just when people leave the water running on their toothbrush.
Yeah, well, toothpaste itself is already 50% water. And, you know, every 2 minutes of the tap is about 5 gallons. So start to think about those people in the third world country again. There you go. You're back to that 5 number again, just from shaving, from, you know, keeping the tap running while we're brushing our teeth, and taking longer showers than probably we need to.
And one more on the number, which is, you said it's a myth that we need 8 glasses of water a day. Now, what are you basing that on?
I am not a doctor. I knew this one was going to come up. It does. There's been an awful lot of studies by the medical profession because they take a look at our food, and we get most of our water from our food. So we don't need as much as what we think. So when they say you need those 8 glasses a day, they're also taking into account the amount of water that's in your food. So certainly I'm not saying for anyone to, you know, drink less water. I don't want anyone to be hydrated. I don't want any liability. There are a lot of people, especially marathoners, who overhydrate, and people who work out a lot, they overhydrate. And that's a big problem that hasn't really gotten the exposure that it might when you start to think about
it. How much of an impact would it make if people cut their water consumption by a cup a day? Or
millions of gallons. That's the thing we forget. You know, there's a few hundred million people here in the United States, and there's almost 7 billion around the world, and you start to do the numbers and calculate it out that way, we can make a huge, huge impact if we all did it. And that's the big thing.
And now there's some things that I thought people would want to explore, mm-hmm. that they could do in their homes, like mm-hmm. the gray water systems and the rainwater capture. And I don't know how difficult that is for people. How hard is it to install something like that? And what are I know there's some regulations around them that make them difficult to do as well. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. suppose our listeners were like, wow, maybe I can just capture rainwater and reuse it for my whatever.
Yep.
Or the gray water.
Yeah, the gray water system is a little bit more tricky because there are a lot of regulations about that, and it does take a plumbing type of equation.
Explain what it is first for some that don't know.
Sure. Gray water is the water after you, say, wash your face and goes down the drain, that comes out somewhere. That's gray water. It's not toilet water. It's not, you know, but it is a form of wastewater. It's not fresh water. So what can you do with that? Now, there are filters that you can use to get rid of, say, the soaps and then use it for your garden. It does get more complicated and more expensive, but you hit on a really good point, which is the rain barrel system. They sell them even at Whole Foods now. You can grab a rain barrel, stick it in your backyard. Some people put them on their roofs or underneath their gutters, and just recapture the rain that falls onto the roof. Now, in an average temperate zone in the United States, a family of 4 can actually live off that rainwater. They don't need to have any other source of water besides that. But when it does rain, we can actually use that. Now, there are 3 states where you actually can't, which is really interesting. In Colorado and Utah and Washington State, it's illegal to recapture or to capture rainwater.
Why is that? Why would they do that?
Because we're on a right of first appropriation law in the West here, as opposed to riparian law in the East. Rainwater, of course, comes down and fills up our streams and our rivers. Right of first appropriation means that if you're a cattle farmer and you came here and say your name's Bob and you showed up at the river and you start to take your water allocation for the year, so Farmer Bob takes his water allocation, that's how much he uses. Then Farmer John comes and takes his water allocation, he gets that for his life. Now, if Bob starts to capture more of that rainwater through his barrels, he's in effect taking away from John's allocation. So there's, you know, kind of a kooky, if you ask me, type of, you know, problem with that. But net, it's a good thing to do here in California if you can, and really, you know, try and reuse whatever we can do, whether it's through the rain or if you have the means and you have the knowledge and you're okay with it to try a gray water system.
The 2 other areas I just wanted you to touch on, before we talk about how much of an impact this actually would make, is travel and sports.
Yeah, I mean, traveling, because I've been traveling a lot for the book now, too, it's really interesting.
How big is your carbon footprint?
Yeah, and how much I do offset. And actually, okay, I must say the water...
Talk about the offset, too, while you're...
Sure, sure. Let me just put in a little plug for the book. It's the first water-neutral book ever to be published. I'm replenishing all the water that went into producing it.
Let me also, since you mentioned the plug of the book, let me also say the title one more time.
Sure.
This is the one that came out on the World Water Day.
That's great.
And it's called the Green Blue Book, The Simple Water Savings Guide to Everything in Your Life. It's really amazing that you've quantified just about every single aspect of life in terms of how much water it takes. And it's got the water calculator in the back so that people who really do want to have an impact can actually calculate their water footprint.
And we just put it up on the site, too. So if you go to thegreenbluebook.com, there's a water footprint calculator people can use for free and just calculate their water footprint. And there's a groovy new video we just put on there, too, that explains a lot of this stuff in
how groovy
an animated
is it?
Way. But to get back to your original questions about travel, of course, when you start to look at not only the amount of water that's used for the plane and for the jet fuel and all that stuff, but planes also do another thing that I hadn't realized until I started getting into the book and the research, is that they disturb water vapor and create, you know, disturbances amongst where rain actually falls. So it really does have kind of a disturbing effect on the atmosphere. And the other thing is the plastic water bottles. When you go through security and you just see them stacked up, it's crazy. So people take the water bottle, they get to security, and they go, oh, I can't even take it through. They end up tossing them out. So, you know, a lot of things like that that require water that, you know, we don't even think about, you know, There's some thinking has to go around that. And then sports. We mentioned, you know, the amount of water that we, you know, could or maybe should be drinking versus, you know, an over amount of water, overhydrating. And then where you actually play, what type of turf do you play on, what time, you know, of year do you play on
is
certain
golf
things.
The worst?
And golf is the worst, but they're also the most conscious, which I found was fascinating. Go on to different websites now, and the PGA is all for kind of water-tolerant turfs. They're all for watering at certain times of the day to mitigate their use. They're really, really getting more and more sophisticated about it, as opposed to just saying, oh, too bad, this is what we do. And then, of course, the skiing community is really scratching its head because of global warming and climate change, saying, yeah, we don't have the seasons like we used to. So, you know, there are things that you can do to mitigate your footprint when you're playing sports, and just, you know, try and be a little bit more conscious as opposed to throwing things out all the time.
Last question for you. If people really did become very water conscious and reduce their water consumption, would it really offset, say, what industry does? Or are we asking ourselves to do what industry should be doing?
I think that there's both of those things entailed, and they're not mutually exclusive. And I think this is where a lot of people feel like, even though they want to do something, and even though they may do a lot of things, that it doesn't make a difference, but it does. One, it makes a difference in your community and to yourself, so there's an ethical proposition there. But also, it sends a message. And if we all could start to, you know, banner around this stuff, it sends a message to industry. Look at the Prius. I mean, you know, perfect example. Let's not get into the technical problems today, but, you know, the fact that actually, you know, it was so well received in the marketplace and it's done so well for Toyota, that it was a message that was sent by consumers. And I think that's the biggest thing that we can do, is really to do things for ourselves that will in turn send a message to business, and hopefully government will start to hear about it as well.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Tom Costigan. This book, the latest one, is called The Green Blue Book, The Simple Water Savings Guide to Everything in Your Life. Thanks so much for coming down and being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.